The characters that Rosie Perez portrays on screen are full of life and often smiling. You could easily get the impression that Rosie Perez herself is a smiling, happy person who had a happy childhood. A smiling, happy person? She can tell us. The happy childhood? No. Rosie Perez gives us the details on a very rocky upbringing, including abusive parents, placement in a children's home, and more, in her just-published memoir, Handbook for an Unpredictable Life, How I Survived Sister Renata and My Crazy Mother and Still Came Out Smiling, with Great Hair. Rosie Perez is a household name, the veteran of many movie and TV credits, including White Men Can't Jump, Do the Right Thing, The Counselor, and Fearless. On TV, it seems like she's been in just about everything, from Frasier to Nurse Jackie. She has won a number of awards and been nominated for several Emmys and an Oscar. We're proud to have Rosie Perez with us on the Jefferson Exchange today. Hi, Rosie.
Hi, Jefferson. How are you?
Good. It's very good to have you here. You write right off the bat in Handbook for an Unpredictable Life, I didn't really want to write this story of mine. Why?
Because it's hard to go there, and because I'm an extremely private person, and also I wasn't emotionally ready to do it, you know, and but I just kept feeling compelled to do it, and I'm kind of glad I did.
What were the forces compelling you to write the memoir?
I think initially it was the students that I work with in my charity. I have a arts ed curriculum, Urban Arts Partnership, that we service over 100 public schools in New York City and in Los Angeles. And I'm always asking the students to share their story. And one of the students said, well, Ms. Perez, what's your story? And, you know, I felt hypocritical, and that always tugged at me. And that was several years ago, you know, and I stood up in the class and I shared with them. And the response that I received was surprising. You know, first the room went silent, and then slowly, one by one, each of the students just gravitated towards me and just started opening up even more about their pain, about their dreams, their triumphs, their failures, everything. And, you know, ever since that moment, I was like, oh, I wish I could just share this with everyone else. And I think that the other compelling component is that I just didn't want to hide anymore. I just, you know, I believe that, you know, certain secrets you should take to your grave and certain secrets should be revealed. And I just didn't want to have that albatross around my neck. I didn't, you know, you have a casual conversation with someone, say, oh, I remember I was a kid and I did this, right? And I would have to divert the conversation elsewhere. And, you know, and that's exhausting. It's emotionally, mentally, and physically draining. And I work so hard on myself to get past most of the pain. And I knew that this would be a further step in achieving that.
You really carried a bit of a wall around with you for a long time then, it sounds like.
Yeah, and it was, you know, for a while, it was, the wall was so, I thought, was so well built that I was able to, you know, chug it along to each stop of my life. You know, and you know, there were leaks that I couldn't keep up. And that's when it became exhausting.
And leave, you know, it to a young person to really nail you, though.
You know, somebody
really,
yes,
early in life, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, out of the mouth of babes, you know.
Right, to put you on the spot, though, and say, so what happened to you, Ms. Perez? Well, you know, away you go.
Yeah.
One of the things you write about was not wanting to be pitied. I mean, it's not like anybody does, but so obviously you felt that there were things in your background that would have been worth pity in another person. Did you feel like you weren't worthy of compassion or something, though?
No, it wasn't that I was worried about that, but let's be clear, the world is very prejudiced, you know, on many levels. And, you know, although we don't have a class system here in the United States, we do. There, you know, people are elitists, they're classists. And, you know, when the issue of poverty comes into play, there are preconceived notions of what poverty-stricken people are. And I just didn't want that on me. I don't deserve it. No one does. And so that's where the pity comes in. You know, they think you're less than subpar or you poor thing. Even as an adult, you know, if you have survived it, as I did, you know. And I didn't want that. I never wanted that. Even as a child, I didn't want it. And it would anger me even as a child, you know, and I just, that's why I put it in there. That wasn't the purpose of the book.
You do mention early in the book seeking counseling. Was this about the time that that the student suggested you come clean, or how did that work time-wise?
No, I was seeking counseling prior to that. Mm-hmm. I don't think that I would have been able to open up with the kids. I probably would have said, well, maybe a later time, let's move on. But, you know, it was years prior to that moment, thank goodness. You know, and it served me well. It really has served me well. You know, and I go back every now and then. It's not a constant treatment anymore. You know, but it it's very, very important. It's very important to be free and be able to enjoy life.
To deal with the present.
Because I do enjoy it. I don't want people to think that my childhood, I was sad 24/7. It wasn't that. I had an undeniable spirit and a sense of humor that was wonderful.
Right. It really was a nonstop. We'll get back into that with Rosie Perez. Her book is called Handbook for an Unpredictable Life. We'll get further into the details of her childhood and how she managed to turn it into a pretty successful adult life. Rosie Perez, back on the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is Rosie Perez, the veteran of movies and TV, including White Men Can't Jump, Do the Right Thing, The Counselor, Fearless, Oscar-nominated for White Men Can't Jump, and many, many, many credits to her name. Her latest credit is a memoir, Handbook for an Unpredictable Life, How I Survived Sister Renata and My Crazy Mother, and still came out smiling with great hair. Rosie Perez, our guest on The Exchange. You can join the discussion if you have some questions of Rosie about herself, her career, her life. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. So let's jump into the story here. Your mother had five kids and a husband other than your father. What happened there?
I don't want to give it away. I want people to read the book. Mm-hmm. But yes, I will say that my mother and father had an affair, and I was a product of that affair. I also want to say that I didn't, just in fairness to the movie makers, I got nominated for an Oscar for Fearless, not White Man.
Oops, I'm sorry. Okay.
That's okay. So, so I was a product of an affair.
Your mother had quite a temper, but it sounds like it went beyond just a person having a temper.
Well, she was mentally ill. She was diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic. You know, not all people who suffer from that mental illness are, you know, have a volatile temper or mean and cunningness to them. You know, but some do. And when it's coupled with a high IQ, that could be just like mental gymnastics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, was very tough.
Your mother, I mean, it sounds like on the surface, a really impressive person, really smart, really pretty. Lydia, her name.
Yes. She wasn't really pretty. She was stunningly beautiful. It was hard as a child when you walk down the street and every single person gasps, like literally, when they saw her walk by. It was just, wow. It's just, you know, it was a sense of pride as well as, you know, just overwhelming too. And she was, like I said, extremely intelligent. And it's, you know, it took me a while to really have empathy for her because it was so blurred with the abuse. You know, here's a woman who is extremely talented. She sang on the level of, like, Marie Callas, and I'm not exaggerating. And she was, you know, extremely intelligent. I asked her, I said, how did you learn English? She goes, I picked up the Bible, King James Version, and I just taught myself. I translated the words from the Spanish Bible. And I was like, wow. I said, when did you do that? And she said, oh, about 15. I was like, geez, you know, who does that? And, you know, and it's sad. It's sad that her mental illness prevented her from being the full person that she should have been.
We have a call here for you. Let's go to Jeannie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Rosie Perez. Her memoir is Handbook for an Unpredictable Life.
Hi, Rosie. I've always loved you. And I handled a similar background. One of the things, dance was my escape. And people would always say, oh, your mother's a genius. And I'd like, let's get to the butt part. Well, then why am I the exception to the brunt of the part of her that's not the genius? And I'll leave that there. And also being in a convent, which actually was a reform school, and the sisters was great in L.A. But I wondered, did you choreograph in Living Color?
Yes, I did.
That was you. Okay, mm-hmm. Great. I just love to hear more of your story. I had no idea of your past till today.
All right. Thanks for the call, Jeannie. Appreciate it. So why don't we talk a bit about in Living Color and the time you spent there?
Well, I was supposed to be the initial choreographer, but there were some things that went on, some politics, and they hired someone else, a wonderful choreographer, but it wasn't what Keenan wanted. And then we met up, and he said, please come on the show, and I did. And it was a great gig. It was a lot of fun. It was very challenging. Keenan was one of the best bosses I've ever had. If you wanted to do something, he allowed you the opportunity. But he was also very quick to say, you know, if you mess up, bullets will be flying. Someone will be fired. And you're like, oh, my God. You know? But I want to just go back to the caller.
Sure.
It's, you know, I empathize with her, you know, some, and I write in the book that it's hard to have a parent who suffers from mental illness because it seems, and I'm not trying to be cruel here, that they have a crazy path for what they do, and that the child should be more understanding. You know, your mother's mentally ill, but she's a great person. You know, and it's like, well, that's a difficult pill to swallow as a kid. And as an adult, too, when that kid grows up, it's like, it's great to forgive. It's great to move on. But it's also great to just have someone say, I acknowledge what you went through, and it was horrible, and I'm sorry, you know?
Have you had a lot of people come forward like Jeannie? I mean, the memoir hasn't been out for more than a few weeks now, but I can imagine that details of it have been out for months now. And so have people come up to you often and said, oh, my God, you gave me the freedom to tell my story?
Yes, and I didn't expect that. That was the last thing that I expected. From the book, you know, I was flying back from, from New York to Los Angeles, and a flight attendant kneeled down, and his eyes are filled with tears, and I go, are you okay? He says, no, I just want to tell you, I read the first few pages of your book, and I suffered from PTSD, from abuse as well, and I never shared that with anybody. And I said, and you don't have to. Just because I did, you don't have to, but I appreciate you sharing it with me, and you know, and even on Twitter, it's just pouring in, and I feel honored in that someone would share things like that with me because of the book. I say that with great humility. I did not expect that response.
So let's come back to some of your own circumstances here, then, because we talked about your mother, her mental illness. Who did you grow up with in those first 2 years?
First 3 years, I grew up with my father's sister, my aunt, Ana Dominga. And I initially I referred to her as my mom because I thought she was my mom. And then later I was informed by the nuns that she was, in fact, my aunt. So I began to call her Tia because she was mommy. So to call her by her name was just weird for me. And I just called her Tia from then on.
I'm struck by how early you report memories in the book that you talk about the moment meeting Lydia, your mother, at around age 3, and this knowledge, and it seems like the circumstances of your life kind of forced you to be more aware of your surroundings at a very early age.
Well, 100%. Well, you know, when you're abandoned, or when you, if you're a child and you're dealt with traumatic experiences, or you're forced to look at the world in an adult way because you're forced to protect yourself, and you can't protect yourself as a child, right? So your subconscious comes forward and protects yourself in an adult way. And I know that's very complicated, but it is true. It was true for me. And as I say in the book, I don't remember every single detail per se. I remember flashes, pictures, feelings, episodes. And I would ask my aunt, and she would fill them in. I would ask my cousin Mili, she would fill them in. I would ask my sister Carmen, and so on. You know, but it is very extraordinary that I did remember as much as I did.
Rosie Perez, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her recent memoir is Handbook for an Unpredictable Life, How I Survived Sister Renata and My Crazy Mother, and Still Came Out Smiling with Great Hair. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. This is a lot to take in for a three-year-old. Wait a minute. The people I thought were my sisters are actually my cousins. The people I thought was my mother is actually my aunt. I don't know this woman who's now my mother. And then, boom, you end up at this children's home in Peekskill, New York, about an hour north of the city. Why? Why did your mom take you there?
My aunt didn't take me there. It was my mother.
I meant mom, yeah.
Yeah, and that's a good question. I have no idea. The only slight explanation that she offered was that, well, actually, she never offered. It was the nuns. They would tell me, oh, well, she can't afford to take care of you. And that made no sense because someone else was taking care of me.
That's the part that really doesn't make sense, is the fact that you weren't living with her anyway, and yet she picks you up and takes you away to Peekskill.
Mm-hmm. So I really don't know. Mm-hmm. I really don't know what was the reasoning. The only thing was that I would justify in my mind was maybe she loved me in her weird way, and it broke her heart that she, you know, that I was being raised by, you know, my father's sister. I really don't know.
The place itself, it seems sort of hard to believe that within our lifetimes there still were places like this, but it sounds like something straight out of Annie. You know?
Yeah. Annie was a fairy tale, trust,
right, yeah.
In comparison. I do have to say that there were some great things about the home. That's how we refer to it. We had an Olympic-sized swimming pool. We had a baseball field. We had an auditorium with a stage, and they would put on plays and that all the kids would act in. We had a music teacher. We had great counselors. We would go to field trips to Bear Mountain, and all of those things are, like, amazing and wonderful. But when abuses comes into play and the fact that you're not home and safe, it's, you know, those were, I had good moments there, but it's just, it was just too much. You couldn't just say, oh, this is a great thing, at least for me. It was great for a lot of kids there. But for me, I still fully couldn't enjoy everything.
Were the other kids there awaiting adoption, or were they in circumstances similar to yours where a parent said they couldn't take care of them and dropped them off there?
It varied. You know, the one thing that keeps popping up incorrectly is that it was an orphanage. It wasn't an orphanage. It was a Catholic home, meaning that, it extended itself not just to orphans, but for displaced children or unwanted children. So, you know, everybody's circumstance was different.
And, you know, you get to the point pretty quickly about the kinds of punishments they doled out at the home. This is not pleasant stuff. I mean, this is beyond the old stories of nuns wrapping kids' knuckles with rulers. It went beyond that, far beyond that, didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, we'll leave it at that. You didn't get many visitors at first, and it sounds like it took a while for Tia, the aunt that you lived with, Ana Dominga, to come see you. And this is one of the most heartbreaking parts of the early part of the book. What do you remember feeling when she finally did come see you?
I don't want to give too much away because then it kills the suspense.
Well, give what you feel comfortable with.
I'm just saying that it was a lot for a little child to take in. It was a lot. I was completely overwhelmed.
Well, here's where things get really confusing. You had siblings as well in the home in Peekskill?
Yes, but I didn't know them.
Wow.
Meaning my mother's children, other children, I didn't know. I was like, oh, this is your sister. Oh, okay, hi, nice to meet you. It was very strange.
Wow, it sounds like. And at this point in your life, though, I mean, because you're still in the formative years, though. I mean, the things you're understanding about relationships and having people in your family are the things that you're learning just from yourself. And it's not like you have other examples around you when you're in a home. I mean, how did you get any sense of quote-unquote normal in family relationships?
In regards to my family relationships?
Mm-hmm.
That occurred when I would go and spend the weekends with my aunt. You know, at first they were just nervous around me, trying to make sure that they don't do anything to upset me. But that went away, like, in minutes. Once music came on, once the television came on, I was always addicted to television, and so were my cousins and my aunt, and we were also addicted to music. So once that came in, that provided the normalcy. And just being casual, you know, with me, it's hard to explain, but, you know.
But there were islands of normality in there that were able to give you an anchor of sorts to figure out what the world was supposed to be like.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's take another call. We have Ann in Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Rosie Perez. Her book is Handbook for an Unpredictable Life.
Thank you so much. I was born to unmarried parents. My mother was manic depressive. I lucked out in that I was my maternal grandparents. I was born at their house, and they loved me as their own. After my grandfather's death, I spent a year on welfare. So I think it was very brave of you to write this memoir. And as you know better than I, this is still a very racist country. And when people find out that they have so many things in common, because your experience, while it has its unique aspects, there's lots of people who have commonality with you. I think it was a very brave thing for you to do, and I thank you for doing that.
All right. Thanks for the call, Ann. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Wow. Thank you.
And here again, Rosie, the people who are thanking you for coming forward, because it in some ways it helps them too. Do you identify with what Ann was just talking about? I mean, you mentioned this being a very classist country, but racist as well, you being Puerto Rican and all?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, when I went upstate New York, which was predominantly white, and I would go to the public schools there, you know, I would be ignored in class. I would raise my hand, and I did that typical, me, please, you know, and I was ignored. I was ignored, and the only time that I wasn't ignored is if I acted out. And I only acted out was because I was ignored, you know, and it's this vicious cycle. And, you know, and she's completely right. You know, the world is completely racist, and, you know, and thank God there are people who are not, you know, and all it takes is us to sit next to each other or share our stories and, like she said, understand that we're human beings with a lot of the same experiences, you know, that happen to be of different ethnic backgrounds. That's it. You know, but first and foremost, we're human beings.
The school you went to when you were at the home, I understand that there were students there who were not part of the home. Is that right? Rosie, you there?
Say that? Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So there were students there who were day students. They didn't live at the home. Did you get a real idea for what their lives were like, what their families were like? I mean, was there a lot of envy there for them?
I wouldn't say envy, because I think, I don't know if it was envy or not. Let's say that I think it was a wanting. It was a there was a wanting when you would see their parents drop them off and then tousle their hair or give them a kiss goodbye or hand them their lunchbox, you know, and then they would be there when the bell rang, you know, because the kids, we called them outside kids, they would come just to reap the benefits of the Catholic school that was attached. And, you know, but it also gave me hope. It gave me hope that, you know, there are good parents and there are normal circumstances that are not just showcased on television.
All right, much more to talk about with Rosie Perez. Her book is Handbook for an Unpredictable Life. We'll come back and talk more with Rosie. We have a phone call waiting. We'll take some more when we come back from this break on the Jefferson Exchange. Back with Rosie Perez and you in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for joining us on the Exchange today. Our guest is Rosie Perez, the shining entertainer of so many movies and TV shows. Well, the life that got her to that moment, not so shining. It's all detailed in her book, Handbook for an Unpredictable Life, subtitled How I Survived Sister Renata and My Crazy Mother and Still Came Out Smiling with Great Hair. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about Rosie and her life, her childhood experiences and how she got to where she is today. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Boyd in Ashland, welcome to the Exchange. You're on with Rosie Perez.
Good morning.
Hi.
I want to thank your author. She's certainly given me some encouragement to write my story. I look very white, but that doesn't solve all the problems, let me tell you. The one of the things I think it should be outlawed is to have a family of four living in an 8-foot-wide, 40-foot-long aluminum box, moving all over the country every 18 months. Walking home from school every day, wondering, did they hook up the pickup in the trailer and leave me behind?
Wow, that really happened?
Exactly.
Really? Yowza. Okay, thanks for sharing with that, Boyd. And here again, Rosie, and people feeling empowered to tell their own stories based on you telling yours.
Yeah, and I recognize the anger and the hurt that's still in him. And I say that without judgment. I'm connecting with him. I get that, you know. And that's why it was so important for me to get help, because it's just, I don't think people are aware of how debilitating that is to carry that around every single day. You know, and you can go to work and function as a proper adult and have relationships, but there's that underlining residual that just stays with you, you know, and I just had to address it, and I hope your caller has too, you know, and, you know, I'm not assuming he has or hasn't, you know, because there are days where, you know, I've worked on myself, and I needed to work on myself because I wanted to have the correct emotional response to others that had nothing to do with my childhood. You know, sometimes I would lash out, you know, but I have learned to, when I do have those moments of anger and pain, I've learned to articulate them where no one else is getting hurt, if that makes sense. You know, and I've learned that it's okay to express that the way your caller just did, so I want to thank him.
Rosie, at what point in your life did you seek counseling? Were you already getting fairly famous by then?
Yeah.
And I ask it because of this reason. I wonder if what you were undergoing was this sort of process where there was this public persona of Rosie Perez that the world was getting to know, and it began to diverge further and further from what you understood about yourself.
Well, I still don't fully understand the public persona, because that's not my creation. That's
right.
An interpretation. That's, you know, it's that's a little weird, but I would say these, when you said I seemed happy, that was 100% authentic. That was 100% authentic me. You know, but I didn't have any room. I didn't allow myself any room or any space to show the other side of it. And, you know, when I was in therapy, it was a safe place for me to do that. But it was so hard for me to go to therapy because I was always looking over my shoulder, wondering, is there a camera around? Is someone going to see me? Is someone going to report it to Page Six? You know, when I would go into therapy in the waiting room, you know, I know that there's a code of ethics that is understood, but is everyone going to be understanding? These are just patients, as am I. I don't know what their level of integrity is, and it was such an anxiety attack going to therapy, and that's funny, freaking hilarious. And, you know, and so I would, once I sat down, I needed 10 minutes just to calm down. And, you know, and I would tell, like, oh, I can't take it. I can't take your waiting room. Everyone's staring at me. I can't take it, you know. And she would just let me get it out. But it was hard. It was very, very hard.
It must have been an additional layer of complexity just choosing a counselor, you know, in some place where you felt like you were safe enough just to be there in the first place, let alone what you dealt with in the sessions.
Yeah, that I give credit to Eve Ensler, the author and playwright of The Vagina Monologues. She's the one that told me that I needed counseling, and I was very insulted.
Which I do not.
Yeah, and she says, I know a great doctor who specializes with adults who've had parents that were mentally ill or extremely abusive. And, you know, thank God for her. It was fantastic.
We have not yet dealt with the name in the subtitle. How I Survived Sister Renata and My Crazy Mother. Your mother we've dealt with, but Sister Renata, she was quite sadistic the way you write about her in the book. So the question for you then, Rosie, is how did you respond to the abuse? I mean, there were times when you acted out and gave her everything that was in your head, but after a while that kind of modified, didn't you? Found other ways of dealing with her.
My best weapons of war against her was I finally figured out the yelling and screaming wasn't working. But if I was silent and just didn't acknowledge her, it drove her insane. And weirdly enough, it made her just kind of go, oh, whatever, I give up. You know, and just leave me alone. She didn't leave me alone completely, you know, but it was tough. She was tough. And in the same breath, I admired the woman. I did. She was extremely smart. She was extremely capable. She ran that dormitory like no one's business. I just wish she wasn't abusive. I wish she wasn't that person.
It's amazing you can talk about her with tones of respect, though, after all this time. The kinds of responses, the survival instincts that crop up in a child in a situation like you were in, though, it bears some benefits, obviously, when you learn survival instincts, but did it allow you to size up situations and people fairly quickly to figure out what they might be, you know, what have the potential for doing to you or with you when you first met them?
Yes. If you got close to me, it didn't always prove effective. You know, sometimes I would get hurt by people. But even today, and a director told me that. He said, you assess people very quick. What is that about? And I just smiled at him. I didn't explain myself. But I can assess a situation like, bam, like that. And you had to. You know, I had to. You had to understand, you know, you're in a home with several other boys and girls that are not related to you, who don't necessarily care about you. Some did, you know, but some didn't. And, you know, and you had to be quick to understand what their motives were. And the same thing when it would come to the nuns or my mom, you know, and also when I would be out in the quote-unquote outside world, I had to be very quick to understand which students know that I'm in the home, which students didn't, you know, and if they did know, are they going to be true friends or if they're not? And, you know, and the negative side to that is that I carried that too much over into my adult life, where my guard was way too up and too strong. and I kind of shunned some people away from because of it.
Did you make yourself lonely as a result?
No, I was never lonely. I know that sounds weird. I've never been lonely.
Mm-hmm.
I like to be alone a lot, but I never was lonely. You know, I've said it before, there was a light inside of me that was undeniable. And one thing that I could always do is enjoy my alone time. I relished in it, you know, with all those damn kids around all the time, please, you know. So, yeah, I never felt that.
Let's talk about some of the major steps in your career then. You had, there was an appearance on Soul Train. Tell us about that and where that led.
Well, that just happened by accident. I went to a nightclub after my science lab class. I was going to college for biochemistry, and we had a organic biology class. And after that, we would always go to a nightclub, and a talent scout from Soul Train saw me dancing and asked me to be on the show.
And that led to choreography work, it sounds like.
Yeah, it sure did. Yeah.
When we already talked about the time on Living Color and working with Keenan Ivory Wayans. Spike Lee, how did you end up getting in touch with Spike Lee and ending up in Do the Right Thing?
Well, it was kind of the same thing. You know, they were having a special night at a nightclub, and they invited the Soul Train dancers to come along to kind of make it, you know, more happening. And it was the week I was leaving. Actually, it was, you know, at the end of the week I was leaving to go back to Brooklyn. I was in L.A. for school. Of college, and my friends, I said, let's go out and celebrate. And I met Spike Lee, and he asked me to be in a movie.
When Spike Lee says, can you be in my movie, you don't say no, do you?
Actually, I said no initially. I was like,
really?
Who are you? Whatever. Okay. And it was my girlfriend, you know, Marion Wade. She was like, are you crazy? I always thank her. I was like, God bless you. Oh, my gosh, I would have been an idiot, you know.
As your career went on, it sounds like you were able to channel some of the stuff from your childhood, which I can imagine probably earlier in your career you didn't want to deal with much at all, but it sounds like it helped you when you developed your character for Fearless.
Yeah, it did. I mean, Fearless is a very vulnerable, acting, you know, experience. You talk about a woman who has lost a child and feels responsible for it, you know, and she's in the depths of despair. And I remember saying to myself, oh, I could do that. That's a snap. That's a walk in the park, you know, but it also frightened me to go there because I could hide behind tough, I could hide behind humor, but I couldn't hide in that role. I had to be extremely vulnerable, extremely exposed. And so that was tough. And the director was wonderful, Peter Weir. He was wonderful, and he had no clue as to where I was coming from, but he was wonderful to me.
Was that the hardest work you've done, would you say?
Emotionally, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
People, you know, doing comedy is very hard. To get the timing down and to make it look like, oh, that's her. She's not acting. She's just being herself. That's not just me. And it's very, very hard. Fearless was difficult in a different way, you know.
Does the comedy come out of coping situations from your childhood? I mean, because, you know, some people do turn on the charm to be able to deflect a situation or just turn up the humor so that it's like, oh, okay, we're all laughing now, everything's fine. So is that part of where the comedy skills came from in your life?
I think just a bit. Not so much for me. One thing I would, give extra credit to is my mother had a quick wit. Man, she was quick with it. And my father was corny as hell. The man was hilarious, you know, and so was my aunt. And I just think it was in my DNA, is in my DNA. Beforehand, and my aunt told me that I was a ham, you know, and if I was at home and they put on the record and they wanted me to go in the middle of the floor and dance, forget about it. The ham and cheese came out. I took center stage. I loved it. I loved it, you know. So I think it's just who I was, you know, and I think that, you know, a lot of kids who suffer from abuse that gets beaten out of them, who they really are, their true essence. And thank God it wasn't beaten out of me, you know.
We have an email here from Debbie in Talent, Rosie, who wants to know if you discovered a universal truth that would help anyone from an abusive childhood.
Go get help. Get past your bath. You won't be able to get past it completely, but you'll be able to make that ocean that you're swimming in into a tiny little pond, and you'll be able to build a bridge over that pond, because it's that water will still be there, but it won't consume you the way it is or has consumed you. And that would be my best advice, is just go get help, you know, because you can't do it by yourself. I'm sorry. I mean, people's, you know, it's great that, you know, there's self-help books out there and yoga and Om and everything like that. But when you come from severe trauma, it's just like war veterans. They can't do it by themselves. They need help, and there's no shame in that.
So go seek help. All right. Rosie Perez's book is called Handbook for an Unpredictable Life, How I Survived Sister Renata and My Crazy Mother and Still Came Out Smiling with Great Hair. Rosie Perez, very much a pleasure to have you on the Jefferson Exchange today.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I want to thank all the people that called in. That was really very touching. Thank you.
All right, Rosie, take care. That'll do it for today's exchange. You can find out more about the program and subjects and suggest a guest at jeffexchange.org. You can also find show topics and recordings on our Facebook page with the same links available on Twitter. Monday on the Exchange at 8 o'clock, it's Sunshine Week, about keeping public records before the public. We'll talk to the people behind the project Who Needs Newspapers. At 8:30, we'll talk about wolf recovery and the prospects for it in Oregon and how conservation groups view the process going along. At 9 o'clock, we'll talk to the people behind a report on big business getting big subsidies in America. That's all Monday on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duren. Our student assistant at the controls today, Reed Newland. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us again Monday at 8 for another edition of the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. And have a great weekend.